GP services across Northern Ireland could soon adopt a hybrid private and public funding model, a leading doctor has said, after opening the first such practice in the history of the state. That's Dr. Tom Black, a GP in Derry. Good morning, Tom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
So what does a hybrid private public funding model look like?
Well, it definitely looks different, Craig. Just to give you a bit of context, we've suffered a lot of funding cuts in Northern Ireland, partly due to Stormont and, of course, partly due to the series of Tory governments we've had that have cut funding to healthcare. So we simply don't have enough funding to run the practices that we've run over the last century or so. So a lot of practices in Northern Ireland have closed their doors, handed back their contract, and the GPs have left. And to be frank, my practice covers the Bogside and Brandy well, and it's a high deprivation area, and we really can't afford to be closing our doors. So we have a funding crisis, and what we've decided is we'll continue with the NHS practice, same standards as before, look after our patients for free, but we'll run in parallel to that a private practice and see patients who aren't registered with our practice. Take a fee from them and use that money to subsidise the free service for our patients. So a bit like the dentistry model in Northern Ireland, which happened about 10, 15 years ago and did a similar thing.
What's the advantage for the private patient then?
Same day appointment, seen promptly, and get sorted. Probably a slightly longer appointment too, which is necessary, obviously, because we don't know those patients as well. And we opened 2 days ago and people are already using the service and they seem happy with it.
But it is possible too, though, because we're talking about health, that the people that we're talking of, maybe those who would visit you normally through the HS, the NHS, but are worried about a sick child or worried about themselves, they might end up paying to access your services.
A good point and a good question, Greg, but I can reassure you that none of my patients will pay to see my service, and all my patients get a same-day service already.
Okay.
So we use a system called Ask My GP. So if you're obviously not registered with me, Greg, because if you were, you would know that every sick child in my practice is seen on the same day.
I wasn't questioning whether you would or not. It's more us as the patients that panic, if you know what I mean. We do have experience. I mean, most GPs are in the same boat. You know what I mean, though. An emotive way of putting it, but I hope you understand my motivation for the way I phrased it.
Important that we make it clear.
Yeah. So why is this not the norm then, do you think? You say it has been adopted by the dental practice. You believe that people will look at what you're doing and saying, right, this is the future of GP care in Northern Ireland.
It will be if they don't find funding. I mean, we don't have Stormont. So let's take an example. This year, there was a 6% uplift to GP funding, and it was supposed to be applied last April. And we've been informed by the Department of Health that, yes, they will give us the 6% as recommended by the body that does the recommendations. But, oh, sorry, we don't have any money. So we won't be giving it to you. That's a very unusual situation. Yeah. There's a contract between myself and them, and they failed to meet their side of the contract. My staff started leaving. I had to give the staff an 8% uplift because we couldn't recruit for the staff that had left, and that 8% was paid for by the bank. The bank, needless to say, have a large overdraft against my practice now, and I literally will go bankrupt and close if I don't find some funding. So it is very strange, but yeah, most practices in Northern Ireland are suffering this funding issue, and I suspect they will copy this hybrid model, yeah.
But we don't really know yet if it will actually work. You'll have to see over time if enough people are prepared to pay to help subsidise those that you see through the HSS. So it's not a fait accompli at this point, I presume.
I've been a doctor for 40 years. I've been a GP for 35 years. Craig, it will be successful.
Okay.
It already is.
Okay, very good. I trust your colleague, Dr. Alan Stout, who said that if you can't make the old model work, no one can. This is the beginning of the end of the NHS as we know it. Would you join Dr. Stout in going that far?
Yeah, Alan Stout's the chairman of the GP committee in the BMA in Northern Ireland. And he's correct. You know, we've had, I mean, my practice is there 100 years looking after people in the bog side. And Stormont, through its incompetence and its dysfunction, is failing to set a budget, doesn't have a health minister, doesn't have the funding to run the services. And it's all falling down around us. There were more than 800 people in the various casualty departments during this week. Our waiting lists are 6, 8, 10 years long. I mean, if you're 60-odd in my practice and you need a new hip, you will die before you get a hip replacement. Mm-hmm. So you have to go and pay for it privately if you want a hip replacement. The whole thing's just falling down around us, Greg. And it's bad politics, you know. And I appreciate the politics in the North and politics in the South. The South is doing better with their health service. People are living longer in the Republic of Ireland. People aren't living longer in Northern Ireland. And in fact, in the UK, life expectancy is dropping, just like America, because they're not applying enough resource to health service. So politics is really important if you want a good health service, and we're failing on both at the moment.
And just finally, just to help me understand a little bit better, who are the private patients? Because as you say, you know, you're committed to if someone has a sick child or some of the scenarios I gave them, that, you know, through the NHS you will see them the same day or very promptly, depending on presumably a little bit of triaging there. I would have thought most people are registered with a GP, and maybe that's the little bit of ignorance that I have. So, like, who is the private patient that is prepared to pay to see you on the same day if you're, many of your patients, if not all, can already see you on the same day, if that makes sense? And sorry if it doesn't, doctor.
Yeah. So my patients can see me on the same day. But for instance, yesterday I had routine appointments as well for same day. But the day before I didn't have routine appointments for same day problems. So I was only seeing people who had urgent problems. Now, you can define yourself what's urgent same day and what isn't, but with the private service, every day is same day urgent, every appointment is same day. So you can see the advantage. If you were a busy professional or even a busy mother looking after a family and you didn't have the time to sit on the phone and wait for the appointment and then get an appointment at the time that didn't suit you and a day that didn't suit you, and the private service accommodates to you and bends to your needs, you can see the balance there. I mean, I don't know about you, Greg, but I can't get to the dentist because I'm far too busy to get to the dentist. That's the sort of analogy.
And do you think with the private patient, you'll see more of the type, which sometimes we all are, that we, you know, we want the script that we want, but the advice that we don't need or we feel?
There's no doubt that there's a slight difference. I mean, I've never worked in private healthcare, and I never thought I would. After 40 years, I find myself in a position where I had no choice and I have to do this to keep the service going for my people on the bog side. And they are my people. This is my community that needs this service. So is there a slight difference? Yes. But at the end of the day, we're very much trained in the clinical model. I'm a graduate of University College Dublin Medical School, and they taught me well down there, thank God. And I work along the same lines as they taught me many years ago.
Okay. Dr. Tom Black, nice to speak to you again. I appreciate it, your time
you.
Today. Take care. That's Dr. Tom Black, a GP in Derry. He has opened the first hybrid private and public funding model for a GP practice. He's certain that it's going to be a success, as you heard from him. And also, there's interest from other GPs to see if this could work for me. All right, okay, what do you think? 086 60 25000. If you're listening to us in Derry, 00353 86 60 25000. And many of you are, by the way. I'd like to hear more from you on the messaging and text machine, because I know you're there, because I've been in Derry and I talk to you. So make sure that you know that this is your show too, and to feel free to raise any issues across the Northwest. We can work on your issues too, be it New West Tyrone, or any part of Tyrone or Derry. The number is for you specifically. This is a call out for you, to you, 00353 86 60 25000, the WhatsApp and text, or 00353 74 91 25000. We hear from many of you. I'd like to hear from more, because I know you're out there, I know you're listening. All right, back with more after this. You know, I heard an advert there during the break for recycling, and we're not afraid to recycle an issue here. And we're going to recycle one of the NCT failure hotspots. It's almost a year, if not a year, since we last spoke to Shane O'Donoghue, editor of CompleteCar.ie, on this issue. But it's a live one and something we probably need to get to the bottom of. I don't know what... good morning to you, Shane, and Happy New Year to you, by the way. Thank you very much for joining us again.
And to you, Greg. Nice to see you.
I don't know, since we talk about it, like half the cars are failing, I'm not sure what is the... What are we measuring that against? Like, maybe that's normal. I don't know if that's good or that's bad, or, you know, 59% of cars are failing. Is there an international standard? Are we... You know what I mean? Like, we look at it and you go, oh, that's terrible, but maybe that's the norm. I haven't a clue.
Well, according to the APP Plus, the company that runs the NCT service, they're saying that the fail rate is fairly normal, to be honest, and that's not abnormal. So I'm kind of surprised that the piece in The Independent today is leading with that information, because that's not shocking in itself.
Well, paper doesn't refuse ink, Shane.
I know. But it draws attention to the issues we still have. And I guess it is the responsibility of every driver to have their car roadworthy, regardless of an NCT certificate and regardless of all the crazy delays we've seen in the NCT service over the last year. It's still up to each individual to have their cars in a good condition.
Yeah, and listen, the failures aren't some are, but they're not on, you know, you're missing a bulb in above your number plate or what have you. There are important things. Wheels and tyres, 10%. Brakes test, 9.6%. Side slip test, 11.2%. Steering and suspension, 14.6%. These are some of the top reasons for an NCT failure. These are the basics, the fundamentals that keep this one-ton-plus machine under control as much as is possible.
Yes, and I guess also, I mean, going against what I just said, those things are kind of hard for owners to check for themselves. Certainly things like the suspension and steering systems, anything that crops up there. So that those are likely to be misalignments in the suspension or misalignments in the steering, which, you know, an experienced mechanic or an experienced person might jump into somebody else's car and go, oh, your car is slightly pulling to the left or something. But somebody who owns the car, and that if that has gradually happened over time, they're probably not even going to notice that. So it's probably unfair to say that it's up to each individual to spot that for themselves. But I would always suggest that it's a good idea to bring a car to a mechanic to check and have a service, whatever, before it's due from NCT.
But is it not a little bit different in Britain and Northern Ireland, in that you can take your car to your local trusted garage, perhaps, that they'll do a run through, check what needs to be done, and then they MOT the vehicle and away you go? We have this system whereby I think it's set up in that an awful lot of people kind of use the NCT as a checklist of what needs fixing. I might be wrong, and maybe that's just what I kind of sometimes think myself, but I just wonder if that's part of it.
Yeah, you're probably right. It is very different in the UK. We have a far more centralised system in Ireland for good and bad reasons. People do use it, as you say, I'll throw the car in and see what happens. But I personally don't understand that, because it takes your own personal time to go bring the car in. And then if you have to bring it back for a retest, I guess a lot of people are hoping that it'll just go through.
But you see, I think this is where garages, if they're not already doing it, are missing a trick. Because I think if they say, come in to us for your pre-NCT service, you know, and if your car happens to fail, we'll fix it for free or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, and market it a little bit differently. That's what I'd be doing. I would say, you know, we'll do your pre-NCT test. I'm not saying you'd fix whatever's wrong for free, but, you know, to offer some sort of level of entitlement, because maybe this is it's not justified, but maybe they're fearful that, well, at least I'll know I'll only get fixed what's broken. Do you know what I mean? So I think the industry could make a shilling out of that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I guess, again, going against what I just said, I think people
it's
are
me
thinking,
supposed
right,
to be arguing with you. You're not supposed to be arguing with yourself, Shane.
I know. It's not normal. It's Happy New Year and all that. I guess if people are thinking, oh, sure, I'll only bring it to the garage if I need to, as opposed to if you have a retest, you have to get things fixed anyway, or people are thinking, right, I'll bring it to the NCT centre only. If I have to get something fixed and a retest, fine. If I get away with it, I don't. Otherwise, if I'm, you know, doing the right thing, bring my car to the garage first, make sure it's all in tip-top shape, and then bring it to the NCT centre, you're still doing two trips, 2 days or whatever, 2 days of your time. So I don't know. Different people do it differently, obviously, but there's clearly enough people out there not having their cars ready for the NCT.
Yeah, and I think this is where the real sort of interesting element of these figures come in, and that's sort of certain areas that have consistently higher failure rates. And we can't really get to the bottom of that, can we? There's a standardized testing system, right? I'm sure there's not a whole group of staff that are particularly fussy. Some might believe there are. I would doubt that very much. So it comes down to particular attitudes in particular areas then, does it? Or how we look after our cars or the state of roads. It is quite interesting when you see the same NCT centres top of the list for failure hotspots. That's the bit that I'd love to dig a little bit deeper into.
Yeah, I think that is really interesting. There is some human element in it, unfortunately. I know it's supposed to be a standardized test and it's supposed to be very simple, black and white, fail or not, but there is definitely some human element. We have heard plenty of anecdotes of a car failing for an item, somebody bringing back and not doing anything and it passing. So, you know, this kind of thing does happen, unfortunately. So whether it's certain testers more lenient, you know, whatever, there is unfortunately a human element there. Now, whether that applies to around the country and different test and different fail rates around the country, I'm not so sure about that. I think what you just said is a good point about the state of different roads. So, you know, we're seeing is that Cavan and Donegal have very high failure rates there. And it's very rural roads, aren't they?
Yeah, so is it more likely to be alignment and steering in suspension in those places because of, you know, hitting potholes? This is stuff I'd love to dig a little bit deeper into. And I just hope it would be lovely if someone associated with it gave us a little bit of an insight, because I don't think it's going to be lighting and electricals in Cavan and Derrybeg. I'd be very surprised if it is. Do you know what I mean? More so than in another area.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if the data clearly shows, and the data exists, of course, if the NCT service shares that data with the right authorities, if the data shows that cars in certain areas are less safe because they're, you know, hitting more potholes and their suspension becoming misaligned more frequently than other parts of the country, then that clearly points to more budget needing to be spent in those areas to fix those roads in the first place. The NCT was set up day one as a road safety issue, and if we're basically just leaving it run without analysing the data and, you know, using a data-led approach to road safety, then we're missing a trick there for sure, aren't we?
Yeah, indeed, and it kind of goes into one of the little hobby horses I'm on, and that we need to one of the contributing factors to road traffic collisions can be road conditions, but we don't talk enough about that. It's often down to the vehicle, rightly so, of course, or the driver, but the road conditions can play its part, and weather, but the actual state of the roads as well, I think, would be useful information. Shane, as always, thank you very much indeed. Before I let you go, surprised, what's your view on seemingly a huge jump in electric vehicles? Is that of any surprise to you?
No, not at all. It's the way we're going. There's a lot more models available than ever before. So last year we saw the introduction of a few dozen new models. And that alone, the extra choice, is going to expand the reach. And everybody's talking about it. The government is pushing for it. They are lower running costs. It is the future. So I suspect we're going to see another increase of the same magnitude this year.
Okay, listen, thank you very much indeed. As always, that's Shane O'Donoghue, editor of CompleteCar.ie. You can check out their website for all your motoring needs, as they say. Let's get to some comments. It would appear that the different levels for the minimum wage based on age is possibly in breach of EU anti-discrimination regulations, which prohibits ageism. I would have thought so too. And I see. Do you know where I see that kind of in the same space as certain businesses? And I'll tell you, they'll not be doing it if there's a financial crash, but certain businesses, hospitality businesses, having over 21 rules, you know, not allowing 18, 19, 20-year-olds in. I see it in that same sort of a space. A caller says, I think the sign at the Green On should say, enter at your own risk, because the council cannot be responsible for safety conditions due to frosty, wet or windy conditions at the site. The only thing is I don't think simply declaring that indemnifies, if that's the right word, the council or whomever owns it, the the OPW, simply putting that sign up in and of itself, I don't think offers protection from claim. I'm open to correction on that, but I don't believe it is. I have to agree with Gary. It's impossible for businesses to survive. I closed my own last year. I just couldn't make money on it anymore. The last 3 years of it, we were losing money. All costs were through the roof and margins became smaller. We looked busy to anybody looking at it, but the reality is we weren't making money. Had to sell everything we owed to pay off everyone. It's the only decision we could make now. Drive for a living and would never become self-employed again. Well, fair play to you. You sold everything off to pay your debts. Not everyone would have done that. There's other alternatives, so fair play to you. Greg, good morning. Just want to let people know to be careful when out eating. My dad was eating in a restaurant in the north where he would go regularly. He was diagnosed as celiac a few months ago and checked with the waitress about food he ordered. It had tobacco onions on top, which he said, or she said, was definitely gluten-free. He was so sick the next day. Right, okay. Morning all. You're out and about, the price of food. I went into a deli this morning for my morning cup of tea and a sausage roll, only to find the price of a single sausage has increased by 30 cents, bringing it up to €1.30 for one sausage. The tea is up 15 cents. I don't understand why the price increased when the supermarkets are decreasing prices, but that doesn't tell the full story of running the type of business you're talking of, but I understand. Football last night, it was good to see Jim back and secure a win, but there should be some rule that a county plays at least half of its senior team in the McKenna Cup. That game was devastating for the youth Armagh lads. They were mostly under 21s, weren't they? And as for the supporters, not fair to be paying to see an A squad destroy a much lesser opposition. Well, it is the McKenna Cup. It was an opportunity, I suppose, for both teams to test things. I'm sure Armagh didn't send that team up just to fulfil the fixture. Their management team probably have an eye on the league, an eye on the championship. And listen, what an experience for young players, even in defeat, to play against a strong Donegal team. So I would say there's more to it from both sides than may meet the eye. Know anything about darts? I don't know anything about darts, but watched the final. Very impressed with the pace of play and mental arithmetic exhibited by both players. Last dart of the seventh set at 42 was a huge turning point. Went 43 instead of 52. Okay, thank you for that. Some of the ring forts in Kerry are either owned by the council and not by the OPW. Others are in private ownership. Good morning, Greg. I was driving in rural Donegal last night and was shocked to meet not one, but two people walking on a main road in the dark with no high-vis. This is a serious accident waiting to happen. And I understand you're using the word accident, but it would be a serious incident stroke collision waiting to happen, because it's not an accident, because someone made the choice to go out in dark clothings on a dark night. And that's a contributory factor. Greg, best wishes to you and all the staff at Highland Radio for a happy and healthy new year. Coming in from Jody in Carndonagh. And Jody, the same to you. And on it goes. Right, let us take a break. We're going to be talking about the different treatment of different people affected by defective concrete. The different approach by government dependent on who owns the property. It's an interesting one, and one we'll be talking about after these. Okay, we're joined on the programme now by Lisa Hone, Chair of the MICA Action Group. Good morning to you, Lisa. Thanks for your time today.
Morning, Greg. Happy New Year.
And same to you, Lisa. And I was reading from Damien Dowds in his show Independence that a double standard is emerging in relation to how we are rebuilding homes which are devastated by defective concrete. Inexplicably, the government's strategy is for private homeowners to build, particularly with the green agenda and what have you, but to build homes to old standards. But the council-owned stock, the state-owned stock, is going to be built to modern standards. And, I mean, it is quite clear. I don't think anyone can dispute that that is a clear double standard. Can you make sense of it, Lisa?
Well, it makes no sense whatsoever, and it is a clear double standard. The first thing I would say is I do welcome the stance that DCC have taken on this. They've obviously been watching and listening. They are as close to anybody in terms of all the twists and turns of the defective concrete crisis. And they seem to have taken on board the reality of the situation. And it is also a positive move for the residents of that social housing. They're talking about demolition as opposed to remediation. This all relates to a tender document that the council has issued prior to Christmas, asking for what they call a design team, which is effectively a team of construction professionals to come forward to manage this from end to end. I mean, effectively, it looks like what they've done in one foul swoop is almost rewritten the DCB scheme for social housing in the county. It appears to be, and I would qualify that with regard to this is quite new information. We've had Christmas, we're seeking clarification on exactly how this is going to work, but it appears to be an end-to-end scheme managed by construction professionals. They're talking about demolition as opposed to part remediation. It's to current regs, or even better, they're talking about NZ homes, which is true proficient homes, disability access if required, re-landscaping, septic tanks. It really is
bells and whistles, really. It's the scheme. It really it's the scheme almost for public owned property. It's the scheme that thousands, tens of thousands of people marched through Dublin seeking for. Now, it's not all there, of course, but seeking for private homeowners. Can you talk to us what the implications of rebuilding to 2007 regulations are? Is that clear? Is that easy to explain, Lisa, the deficit that is there between those regulations and sort of where we are at now and where we're going?
Well, I think a lot of the big ones do relate to energy efficiency. Now, you know, the department would argue that homeowners who apply to the DCB scheme can avail of SEAR grants. But I can tell you for a fact that there is no straightforward route there. And, you know, it is an absolute nonsense. It's quite irresponsible, quite honestly, that we've got a scheme where it's 6 months into the scheme and we don't know exactly how homeowners should even proceed to avail of those SEA grants. This could all be done away with. They've just made it way more complicated than it needs to be. That could all be done away with if you just built to new standard regs as a part to old standards, and then to try and tack on renovations via SEAI grants.
And all the money is coming from the one pot. It's not like there's a different revenue stream for the grants versus the defective concrete block scheme. It is inexplicable. No one could explain it to me in a way I could understand, I don't think, because clearly you're talking about the same arms of the state. You say, right, okay, well, why would we have them go through a process of applying for grants? We'll just adjust the scheme to ensure that the house is built to a certain standard and keep Eamon Ryan and the Green Party happy at the same time.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is what we've got to remember. We've got a Green Party coalition and they are part of the party.
But where are they in this conversation? Like, I can't get access to a lot of these people anymore because I ask too pointed questions, I think, sometimes. But in fairness, Eamon Ryan has come on the show and I'm sure he will into the future. I'm not blacklisted there. But my point is like, it would be very interesting to hear from Eamon Ryan what he thinks of this scheme, that it's disincentivizing insulating our houses to current standards.
Yeah, what the DCB for private homeowners recommend is directly in contradiction to every single government policy that is being push forward with regard to energy and environmental concerns. So it's an absolute, it makes no sense whatsoever. And one would think that, you know, a scheme that deals in billions should be a legacy project. There should be no short-termism with regard to, as you know, something that is going to cost billions. That should be looked way, way into the future. And if you're not prepared to build to current regs, energy efficiencies, environmental concerns, it makes no sense. And on top of that, we've got a Green Party coalition advocating that we should build to, you know, nearly 20-year-old regulations. The hypocrisy, Greg, is utterly off the scale. And I would love for, you know, to come on the programme and speak to Eamon Ryan. I will be there if you can get Eamon Ryan on, because we have been pushing and shoving from all angles to try and get a Green Party response to the DCB scheme, and we can't get anything either.
Yeah, well, listen, we'll make our inquiries again. In relation to the scheme in and of itself, is anyone moving through it at the moment? Because, like, in terms of the current scheme, the jury's still out on foundations. There's new scientific evidence now to suggest that really we need to be tossing these houses, lifting the foundations, starting from scratch. We heard from the head of the council himself. I asked him if he had to avail of this scheme, would he rebuild his house on the old foundations? And he suggested, and I hope I'm not misquoting him, he said that he would try and source the funding to change the foundations as well. So all directions of traffic are going in the one way. Is anyone accessing this new scheme, or is it to wait and see, or we're seeking clarification, or when the next announcement might be made? What's the situation at the moment?
Yeah, I just pick up on that, Greg. That's a really good point with regard to the foundations. And that is something that we need to seek clarity from with regard to this tender in terms of how the council is going to tackle foundations. Because as you rightly point out, when John McLaughlin appeared on the show with you a few months back, he did advocate to homeowners that if they could lift foundations, that's what he would advocate. So one can only imagine that if he's putting in place a council-led scheme, that's what he will indeed advocate. So that is a key point that we need clarity.
Actually, we might make an inquiry to the council directly, looking for clarification on that specific point, because I think that is actually, as well as the standards, that's actually, I think, of equal importance. But go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, it is very fundamental. And obviously, as you know, there was the latest tranche of scientific research. And this is the research was commissioned by government. You know, so this is their own research done in a way that they asked to be done. And that is vindicating that at the moment, we cannot guarantee any part of the concrete that contains the defective aggregate.
And it poses the interesting question about the whole scheme, which I thought was a fascinating question, we need to decide what a house is. Is a house 20 years? Is a house lifetime? Is a house to be bequeathed? You know what I mean? Because if it is to be there for 100 years, well, then all the concrete has to be changed, because it all contains defective elements and it will all deteriorate, maybe at different paces, but it will. So that, I think, we have to decide how long people are entitled to a home for as well, which forms all part of that new science, I think.
Yeah, and I think also you've got to think about the sort of mental strain on people as well. There is that legacy issue in terms of, you know, a home should be built with a view that it's going to be there for generations to come. It should be there for our children and grandchildren, and it should be a legacy in the county. You know, good standard homes. But I think you also have to think about the mental strain of somebody living in a home, not knowing if that home is potentially going to fail again in the future. And it's that uncertainty. And I think that's a word that crops up, you know, in conversations with homeowners affected by this issue all the time, this uncertainty. And it sort of gnaws and grates on people's mental health in terms of, is my home good? Is it going to last? And dealing with that, you know, for years and years to come, you cannot put people into that situation. It's almost abusive. You know, those are really, really big issues. And you're not talking about potentially huge amounts of cost to make a home potentially good for a couple of decades, or a home good for generations.
Even the cost things, it's multi-generational. There's a huge clawback from the state in the building process. Do you know, like, I'm not saying for a second that this isn't a burden on the state. Don't get me wrong, of course it is. But this is long finger stuff as well for many, many of these homes. It's not going to be 300 billion this year. That's ridiculous. I mean, we're going to be competing for builders with the council now, for crying out loud. They're looking for them to build projects together and tie them up for years. God knows who's going to build all of the private houses as well, and that's no slight on the council. But this is multi-generational potentially, and as I say, there's a huge clawback in a lot of the spend from government, not to mention the fact that it should be trying to get some money back from the insurance companies and the banks as well. Do you know, it's, I can't believe we're still having this. I can't believe that logic and decency isn't prevailing here. And if that sounds like I'm on the side of the homeowner, I make no apologies for that.
Yeah, and that's it, Greg. And what we've got a government that resists logic, resists facts, resists science, resists expert opinion, resists the experience of the homeowners. And it is that, you know, cloth-eared, arrogant approach I'm not gonna, you know, mince my words. It is an arrogance of policy decisions being made by people who are insulated, who are just not taking on board. You know, they would claim to have meaningful conversations or meaningful engagement, I think is the term they use. It's not, because they're not listening to the logic, the science, and the experience of homeowners. And the result of that is they're not making the right decisions. And this is, you know, the latest, you know, this scheme really, the difference between the DCB scheme that's been given to the private homeowners and the council we're on, that's vindication of everything that the campaign has been pushing for the last number of years.
A caller says, if your defective concrete block house is built in 2015, do you have to rebuild to 27 regs? I'm not sure when the regs changed. I think, you know what I mean? I'm not sure if maybe, is there different regs in 2015 versus 2007? If there are, yes, you have to go backwards in relation to that. But I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't know how often the regs have been updated.
That's exactly it. I mean, again, you know, the illogic of the DCB scheme. You could have a home that is built much more recent standard regs, or you could have built your home over and above the regs at the time, which some people did with regard to, you know, energy concerns, etc. However, if you partake of the DCB scheme as it stands at the moment, that's it. We go back to the 8 regs. So,
and listen, what that boils down to, by the way, and you correct me if I'm wrong, what this boils down to is 100% redress, right? Because I don't think the expectation is that someone will build to 2007 regs. It's that what they'll do is they'll put their hand in their own pocket or go back to the bank and build it up to current regulations. And then, of course, if they choose to do other... So in other words, this is about where I see that important. It's about the 100% element of this. Now, I don't think anyone accepts that this is a 100% redress scheme. I haven't yet to speak to anyone that believes that they can replace their property without having to reborrow or dip into savings or whatever it might be. Maybe you can correct me on that one again, Lisa. But that's what this is about, isn't it? It's about, you know, you're going to probably build to more modern regs, but you're going to pay for it. Of course, less the SEAI grant.
Yeah, and that really goes back to what you were saying before, excuse me, in terms of who's availing of it. And I think it is those people, you know, I think those people who maybe have that resource to be able to push forward, to be able to dip into savings or borrow as required, you know, in terms of those people who maybe can strip out foundations without being financially supported. But it's pushing everybody to the limit. You know, it's not easy. People are making huge sacrifices. But you've got people who are absolutely desperate to get to the other side of this. You know, they are just trying to employ every sort of, you know, sort of method to be
but,
able
but
to...
But there's, like, old, there's, many, o- there's, a, m- there's many older people that simply can't borrow. Exactly. There's people who credit rating has gone through the floor. There's people who are already paying a €1,500 mortgage with 30 years to run on it or 25 years to run it. They simply can't go back to that well again. You know, and people are at the same time having to try and send their kids to college and not being able to do so because money's being taken away from that resource. Like the ripple effect, the ramifications for so many families. Yes, there are those that can say, stuff it, I want this behind me. We have that, you know, €120,000 nest egg. I don't know. I don't think there's that many of them, but they're out there. But I think an awful lot of people simply are probably just hoping something changes and keeping their head down as much as they can for 2023 and see what happens. Is that the feeling you're getting, Lisa?
Yeah, that's definitely the case with some. I think that those maybe who have more resource, they maybe have skills, they maybe have financial resources behind them, they may be able to find a way to get through. And there are definitely those, and certainly those in vulnerable situations, those who do not have the financial resources, those who do not have the physical or mental capacity to deal with this, because this is a really, you know, it's a serious undertaking which tests the best of us. And this is why we need an end-to-end scheme. This is why, you know, I'd go back to what the council are doing. That's exactly why we need an end-to-end scheme, because a lot of those issues would be taken away, because suddenly then, you don't have to project manage it. Suddenly you're not looking for shortfalls, because we're under the guise of an end-to-end scheme. The financial responsibility comes into the management of that authority that is actually managing it.
But also, too, rather than us individually trying to get contractors, if there was a bit more oversight, group houses into group 10 houses around Malin together and get a contractor in and maybe get it cheaper or what have you. I don't know, maybe that wouldn't be financially beneficial, but I mean, like, let's take the council model and copy it.
Yeah, and I mean, you would think that would make economic sense, Greg, because, you know, there must be, if you're building thousands of houses, there must be economic gains to be made, economies of scale. I mean, what the government has actually done with the DCB scheme for the private homeowners as it stands, it's almost created a sort of micro competitive environment. So we're already under pressure to get hold of trades, developers, etc. And then what in terms of, you know, nationally, and then what the government has done here is literally pitched homeowner against homeowner and created this extra sort of competition within the DCB.
But then they've also pitched those with resources against those that don't, because of the way the money comes through, and you know, maybe some being able to front load and others not being able to. So it's a problem within a problem within a problem, Lisa.
Yeah, and it's really irresponsible because the converse of that is if you did have an end-to-end scheme and a much more systematic approach of working through all the houses, getting the economies of scale with regard to the buying in of materials, the use of contractors, etc., that would actually, you know, you could benefit from the economies of scale as opposed to be pitching homeowner against homeowner.
Right. Okay. A caller says, "How can we be sure this is happening? Have you read the document?" It was my understanding it was only a draft document. Well, listen, Damien Dads wouldn't have done the story in his own Independent if he wasn't sure. Even if it is a draft document, it's far better than any draft document that was made for private homeowners. In any case, has this been formally sent out? Is it a working document at this point? Do we know, Lisa?
It's part of the way that the council issues for tender competitions. So it goes out on a system called e-tenders, and it's basically them saying, we would like relevant parties to
put beyond the draft.
For this particular project.
Okay, it's beyond the draft. Lisa, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it. And we'll chat again, of course, over the course of this year. It is the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. Dr. Anthony Breslin, as you know, is a consultant in public health with the HSC in our area here, and he joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Doctor. Thank you for your time.
Good morning.
Now, an appeal has gone out to the public to, if they feel unwell, well, what is your advice, Anthony? I'll just leave it to you to speak to the public.
Well, basically, there's a number of things people can do. Obviously, first of all, it's not too late to get your COVID or flu vaccine. It may not help you in the next couple of weeks, but it will kick in about 3 weeks and reduce the impact if you do become infected. So that's one thing to remember. And the vaccine is still available from your GP or from your pharmacist. For health service staff, there are a number of clinics available too. If you know someone is sick, stay away from them. And vice versa, if you are sick, stay away from other people, particularly those who might be immunocompromised at the very young or the elderly or with an underlying condition. And if you can self-medicate, do. That's your sort of your paracetamol and painkillers and Sudafed, whatever. You can also get advice from your pharmacist. And if that doesn't help you, then make contact with a GP and get a GP visit. Only go, as it were, to the hospital on your GP's advice or if you are ill. Now, we're not saying you shouldn't go. We're not trying to get people to stay at home if they need to go to hospital, but just to sort of cut down the risk to other people and to cut down the number of people attending hospital.
There's a lot of flu out there. COVID, as you mentioned, RSV. A dozen people that have been really laid low by proper flu, in inverted commas, and COVID as well. People seem to be getting a big hit with that. And then RSV, there are vulnerable groups potentially out there as well. We're trying to limit the spread of this like we would any time, any year at this time.
Yes, I mean, RSV is decreasing, thankfully, but still the numbers are high. Flu and COVID, we think, might be reaching the peak very quickly and will decrease over January, but that's still a number of weeks to go. So if people can avoid getting infection, as I said, giving simple advice there, if they're out and about, just stay away, if they have symptoms, stay away from people. And basically, infection control, cough into a tissue or their elbow. Advice, some places now around the country in healthcare settings are beginning to use face masks again for going into healthcare settings. Mm. So that sort of approach, back to where we were last year and the year before for a short term.
And I think, Anthony, if you don't mind me saying it, and contradict me if you see fit. Look, I get that there's going to be a hangover and a backlash and a pushback from people who resistant to measures that came in during COVID, right? But at the same time, COVID, flu, RSV, for people already sick in hospital, there's no medical dispute on this, right? For people or in residential care settings, if they get a bad flu or a COVID, or if people want to call it whatever they like for their own mind, that's fine. You don't want to be given, regardless of your views, you don't want to be given people these illnesses when they're already sick.
No, you don't, because you don't know what's going to happen. They might have sniffles, they might end up with a bad chest infection, and some of them might get very ill and then requiring hospitalisation, and they might die. And you don't want to put people in that position. You're totally correct there.
Right. Letterkenny University Hospital already has a mask mandate for all visitors. I'm hearing from listeners that it's not being observed routinely, but that's just a couple of people that have said that. They're also asking people, which I think at any stage, who are sick, not to go into hospital to visit people. Presumably you think that's a sensible approach.
Totally, yeah. I mean, hospitals are high-risk places. There's a lot of sick people there, and I'm not being facetious there. There are people who have underlying conditions. They have cancer, they're on chemotherapy, they're immunosuppressed, etc. They're undergoing dialysis, whatever. They are very, very vulnerable. And if you have any symptoms, you should stay away because you don't want to put those people at risk.
Dr. Anthony Breslin, thank you for your time today. He's consultant in public health with the HSE. Right, time for a few comments. It's taken me since August 23 to get a BCA cert from an architect. Well, that's a long stand, isn't it? Morning. Do the government and council think that anyone wants to be in this scheme? I'm on the old scheme and I have yet to be contacted by the council with regards to the new scheme. It's a joke. And we did hear that it would take some time to move everyone from the old scheme to the new scheme. Hi, Greg. It's disgraceful the way this government has treated the Donegal people. Their houses falling down around them. My sister can't sleep at night with stress. I hope they're wiped out at the next election, this caller says. Also, council never notified me as of new requirements for enhanced scheme, even though I have an original application number. It's going backwards, they say. And on it goes. Listen, any comments or calls we didn't get to, we'll carry them over till tomorrow, of course. We have our Friday panel, the first of 2024, lined up for you. Seamus Gunn is answering your legal questions. Get them into us right now. It's not too late. And so much more besides. Rejoin us at 9. But for me, Greg Hughes and Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the show, and Shannon working really hard with us as well. Have a lovely Thursday and stay tuned.